It seems like the term, it's like, well, at least I didn't. There's a few people that say what they, because they're really involved. And then.
Could we call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this May 8th? I think we should be out in the sun rather than a committee meeting, but here we are working
I'll
together.
I'll second that motion.
I said that's where we should be, not where we're going to be. I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 52A. Madam Administrator, what do we have?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 52A comes to you at the request of the Oregon Health Authority. It directs the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules for ambulance service providers to report patient encounter data to the department's electronic emergency medical services data system. It requires the ambulance services providers to report the patient data to OHA's data system, grants OHA rulemaking authority to specify the type of patient outcome data to be reported. There is no revenue impact, Mr. Chair, minimal fiscal impact, Mr. Chair, and committee members, no amendment before us at this time.
Call the panel, please.
Dr. Dana Selvor and Nan Heim, please.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Dana Selvor. I am the section manager for healthcare regulation and quality improvement. I also serve as the state EMS and trauma director at the Oregon Health Authority in the Public Health Division. And I'm here today to support Senate Bill 52 for many years, which we've been working on, which mandates ambulance service agencies to report their patient care data electronically to our state data system. The healthcare regulation and quality improvement section does a lot of things. We have the health facility regulation group. We have some other groups. And we also have the state EMS. And the state trauma system. And what we're talking about today is the state EMS system, which has a lot of charges in statute, one of which is to establish the state EMS system and to establish the statewide educational requirements. We also have the trauma system, and we're also directed to establish a statewide data system. We provide other things such as regulatory oversight of ambulance agencies and EMS providers such as paramedics, emergency medical responders, and the like. In order to do that, we really do need some reliable, timely, accurate, and data for the system. The authority has been working for about 5 years on a proof of concept with the state Department of Transportation supporting us, and we have a state EMS system after a couple of decades. We finally have one, and we've had it for about 5 years, but it is voluntary reporting at this time, and so we'd like to make that official. We also, in 2016, we had about 334,000 EMS patient care records that we received. About 66%, latest count of the 32 licensed ambulance agencies are reporting to this system. Passage of the Senate Bill 52 would allow us to basically have a formal system with timely, accurate, uniform, complete, integrated, and accessible data. And so that data can be used for many things, but most prominently, the trauma hospitals are interested in having that pre-hospital care data flow in a little bit more usable format than a fax that they receive from the ambulance agency, which is the way they've done it in the past. So this system would allow the data to flow in that direction. It would also allow the data from the trauma hospital and those patient outcomes to flow back to those pre-hospital care providers to understand how they're doing clinically and how they're doing operationally. And so in that way, it's a dual benefit for them. We had some conversations in the first round with the stakeholders, and we made a couple of changes to the bill. I'll just report those real briefly. We eliminated the reference to EMS providers, individual providers. That was a drafting error and a communications error. So it's only licensed ambulance agencies, and those are the transporting providers that go to the scene or wherever and pick up that patient and take them to the hospital. So we also delayed the mandatory reporting until January 19, having the rules in place in January 18, but the reporting won't happen for a whole year. So people will have time to respond to it and to get up to speed if they don't already have a system. It will allow the authority to temporarily waive electronic reporting for some of those agencies until for a few years while they're getting up to speed. So some of the smaller agencies might need more time and might need more resources and assistance from us to be able to report. So we have a waiver system in place. And then it also requires us to address interoperability issues. In rule issues have been seen that we have a free system that's available to anyone, and about 50% or so of the AMITS agencies currently reporting use that. The others use their own system, but they obviously need a connector piece. They need to be able to have those systems talk to one another so that they can upload the patient care data that they're already reporting to the state. And then finally, they asked for an annual data report, which we put into the statute. And those are the changes. I would be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Talking with some of the senators who voted no, they expressed concerns about data being shared and collected inappropriately with OHA, and I wanted to hear your response to that.
Representative Kenemer, Chair Greenlick.
A modest question.
No, it's a very good question. And when you're talking about data systems, that is really, really important.
Yeah.
And we appreciate that. The data will continue to be protected. There is, I think it's Section 3, I want to say, sorry about this. Section 3, subsection 4, there is a discussion of the data being protected as confidential medical records and that will continue to be privileged data. At the Public Health Division, we have administrative systems in place that ensure that our policies and procedures that our data is only shared under data use agreement and it's reviewed. So the data isn't shared with everyone at any time. There are controls around that. Most of the data is used internally for the regions to go ahead and look at what they're doing, for the ambulance agencies by region to look at what they're doing, and of course for all sorts of things, for emergency preparedness and response. But those are all controlled through the public health agency's administrative procedures and policies.
Follow up.
Yes.
Is the data separated from the name of the patient?
Representative Kenworth, Chair Greenlake, Vice Chair knows. The data is reported, so it is identifiable, the data. It is not always shared as such. So they have to demonstrate a need to know why they need to know that. So if a patient, for example, if a region wanted to know, or let's say an ambulance agency, of course, that they wanted to use the data for themselves, they do want to know who that patient is, or that trauma hospital wants to match the patient name, right, to the pre-hospital data. So they want to know, and they will know, and they have that the matching data. If they don't have a need to know, if they just want to understand in Central Oregon how many types of, or Oregon Department of Transportation wants to know how many types of which type of accident happened, or how many stroke cases there were, and they want to know general data, then that will be available in that fashion.
That would be de-identified.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Nan, you want?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, Vice Chair Hayden, Vice Chair Nose, and members of the committee. My name is Nan Heim, and I'm representing the Oregon State Ambulance Association in support of Senate Bill 52. Our members are public agencies and private companies that are the designated 911 emergency transporting agencies. We had two initial concerns about this bill, both of which the agency and Dr. Sulliver have addressed. One of them was the rural providers and whether or not they would be able, the small ones, whether or not this would be a very great task for them. And as Dr. Sulliver explained, they have taken several steps to address that. We also will be, we are going to do a workshop in conjunction with the Stadium S Conference this September and next September, specifically for these agencies to try to learn how to do this. We also, as we have done for years, provide scholarships for the rural entities to be able to attend the conference. Our other concern was... being sure that we got the information back. Our agencies are very eager to have this data for system improvement, and so we asked for the amendment to be sure that there is a report issued that we can access. And so with those changes, we support the bill. Thank you.
Any other questions in the panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's close the public hearing. Senate Bill 52A and open a work session on Senate Bill 52A.
Are there any amendments?
Yeah. No amendments.
No. Okay.
But let me see if our other member wants to vote on the bill.
I'd like a recess.
Sanities.
Jeez.
Jeez. We're back in order. Have a motion, Representative Nunes.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we send House Bill, Senate Bill 52A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nunes moves Senate Bill 52A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
Yes.
Representative
Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative
Kinnemer. Aye. Representative Malmstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Excuse.
Vice Chair Nose.
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden.
Yes.
Chair Greenland.
Aye. Motion carries. I'll carry it. Closing work session on Senate Bill 52A. You keep track of who might be missing different bills.
Absolutely. Good. Thank you.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 275A. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 275A permits a covered entity to deny request for a copy of health information regarding an individual who is appealing the denial of a Social Security disability benefits if requested by a person other than the individual or the individual's personnel representative without valid written authorization signed by the individual. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we do have an amendment on this bill that I believe the folks will be speaking to. There's no revenue, no fiscal impact on the bill. This left the Senate floor with 29 ayes, one excused.
Can you call a panel, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We have Mark Bonenno and Bob Jundeff. Is this the right bill? 275?
This is 275A.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And then last would be a Scott Sell.
You look puzzled.
Yeah, you do. Mark will kick us off.
You want me to start?
Please.
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 275, the engrossed version. I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association, where I act as their general counsel. You have the written testimony of OMA. I'm just going to
hide.
Pardon?
Your name?
Mark Bonanno.
Thank you.
You have the written testimony from OMA. I'm just going to highlight 3 points and then leave time for questions that you might have. First, OMA physicians and their clinic staff support and care for their patients. They want to ensure that patients gain access to services and benefits. This is why OMA supports SB 275A as written. 275A clarifies that patients may obtain additional treatment records needed to support their appeal of a disability claim. Our understanding is that this is the time period after the date of initial application for benefits up to the date of the appeals hearing, which can be as long as 2 years. The second point I wanted to make is that due to some apparent vagueness in Senate Bill 710 from the 2015 session, we heard reports from member physicians and their clinic staff that they were being harassed by some law firms demanding access to records. The attorneys were claiming to be personal representatives. HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, does not include attorneys in its definition of personal representative. Demands were being made for entire charts, even covering periods prior to the application for disability benefits. Demands of these clinics included threats of intimidation, threats of fines, threats of lawsuits, and again, just general abuse of what we thought was a simple statute back in 2015. It's important to remember that our members, our physician members and their clinics, they support their patients' right to access records and generally provide copies to those patients at no charge. We understand that some attorneys may want to obtain records from prior to the initial application for benefits, even though the Department of Disability Services would already have those records with respect to the initial application. We believe that 275A helps alleviate some of these abusive practices. And to be clear, if attorneys want more access to records beyond what 275A allows for in disability appeals, they may obtain copies of records with proper authorization. And rather than burden their clients with the cost for those records, we understand they're permitted under the Oregon ethics rules for attorneys to pay for those records on behalf of their clients while awaiting the outcome of the appeal. I'll stop there for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Somebody?
You both signed up.
Thank you. My name is Scott Sell. I'm a disability attorney. I help disabled Oregonians obtain federal benefits. And I think I'd like to start just by talking about this proposed amendment and how it would affect applicants for Social Security benefits. So as the law presently stands...
Which amendment are we talking about?
Oh, so it came out of the Senate committee amended, and I understand there's an amendment before this committee.
Are you talking about an amendment, or are you talking about the Senate version?
Let's start by talking about the Senate version. So that version, as it came out of the Senate, currently says that the protection of the bill begins at the application date. So that creates a loophole in which a certain number of individuals would be missed by the protection of the statute. In Social Security law, the way it works is a person applies for benefits after they become disabled. As you might imagine, most people don't believe that they're disabled as soon as they've developed a disease or had an injury that would prevent them from working. There's a period of time, could be months, could be weeks, in which that person thinks that they're going to get better and thinks that they're going to return to work. Okay, ultimately they realize that they're not going to be able to return to work. They're disabled, so they apply for benefits. That's their application date. The way the bill stands as it came out of the Senate committee, there's a period of time from the date that they became disabled till the date that they decide to apply for benefits, which is not covered by the protection of the statute. So we're suggesting that you amend the bill, and instead of using application date, you use alleged onset date. Alleged onset date is a term of art used in Social Security law. It's defined in federal regulation. I'll be submitting my written testimony, and my written testimony will include a printed copy of the federal law defining that term. It's a concrete term. So that's our thoughts regarding the proposed amendment before this committee. But if I may, I'd like to talk a little bit about just what this law would do and how it's affected people already. So as you're aware, Senate Bill 710 came out of the 2015 legislature, and it became codified as ORS 192576. At my firm alone, that statute has helped hundreds of disabled Oregonians of limited financial means obtain medical records, which in turn are key in obtaining federal disability benefits, which lessens the burden on the state.
Have you seen the Dash 2 amendments?
Yeah. Yes, I'm aware of
them. Is that the one you're referencing?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you.
Before the Senate, if you look in the bill file, there's testimony from a wide swath of Oregonians who were helped by the statute. There's testimony in the bill file from former interim commissioner of Multnomah County discussing the difference that this statute made in her life. She is also one of those people who fell in the loophole, someone who did not apply for disability benefits until some period of time after she got sick. Her testimony talks about how there would be a period of time in which she would be unable to access the protections of this law based on the fact that she didn't immediately seek benefits. There's also testimony from a former laundry worker with an intellectual disability about the difference that this statute made in her life. And last, before I finish, as I did when I testified before the Senate committee, I'd like to just walk through how we use this bill. I understand that OMA has suggested.
We have a lot of work to do today, so...
It's quite important to me to just list these couple bullet points for the record.
A couple of bullet points.
Okay, so this is how we use the law. I invite clients to complete a statement invoking the statute and requesting that the records be delivered to my office. My office sends that statement along with appropriate HIPAA releases to the medical records providers. My office tracks the records. My office responds to any invoices received, and my office submits those records to the Social Security Administration. My understanding is that this method is permissible under the bill as it exists now and permissible under the bill as it would be amended under this, the amendment that's before the House right now.
Bob? Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Executive Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And I really appreciate being able to talk to you about this bill. I know you have limited time, so I will not take too much of it. This is one of those situations in which there are no bad guys. This is a situation in which all the parties recognize the social benefit of getting people onto Social Security disability, both SSI and SSDI, who need it. Not only does it keep them from being impoverished and being homeless, but it also allows health care providers to be paid and for supports and services to be available to people who need them in order to remain in the community and not in our facilities that in the state that are much more expensive. So this is an overall good mission. I was involved in the passage of Senate Bill 710 back 2 years ago. And what we understand from our testimony from the Medical Association is that there's been reports of abuse by some attorneys. A couple of points. The first is that in full recognition that I am an attorney, so I understand we're dealing with doctors and lawyers here, and that can raise some debate in and of itself. However,
you don't act like an attorney.
Thank you, Chair Greenland. The attorneys who do this work, for the large part, are not making a pile of money on this, and they do not have a war chest to aid their indigent clients to apply for benefits. This is a fairly, in my observation, a low-margin area. So we are very happy to see practitioners coming forward and doing the work on helping people get disability benefits. In terms of that practice, my experience is that most applicants are denied benefits on the first try, and then they appeal, and most appellants get benefits. So what's the difference? The difference is that many people who apply don't understand the process, which is very bureaucratic and detailed. They don't understand what's needed, and they're not very good at organizing whatever materials that they have. And so by the time they actually get someone to help them out, and oftentimes that's on appeal, and they have an attorney or, in some instances, another administrative advocate, they have someone who can get the materials that they need, put them in the correct order, make the case, and it's a dramatic turnaround. So there's a benefit to having access to those materials. As I understand this, the bill before you is that it would limit the free materials to those that happen after denial up until the date of appeal, which is better than nothing. However, oftentimes what that legal practitioner does is go search for materials that the person was too disorganized or unable to find to begin with. And those are the materials that actually make the case. So I think that, as I understand the problem here, and I may be wrong, is that from the medical side, is it's ease of administration. That's their concern. They want to be able to not have to go through a lot of hoops in order to determine whether a request for other documents is legitimate, not legitimate, repetitive, whatever. However, I think if we want to further the social purpose of this law, that we should craft an exception that allows those documents to be obtained. I have not seen the Dash 2 amendments. I don't know if they do that or don't do that, but if they do, I think that would be a good thing.
No. Have you seen the Dash 2?
We have seen the Dash 2s, and the way we take a look at it, it just seems to make the language a little more vague. We're trying to be more specific here, you know, to avoid the calls to our clinics that are threatening and intimidating. So, you know, as written, we don't think we could support the Dash 2s.
I understand there are two sets of issues. One is the multiple requests for records, and the other is the starting point of the records that can be requested for. I understand the Dash 2 only deals with substituting the alleged origin.
Alleged onset.
Alleged onset for whatever else is in that place. And that's the only issue it gets to. It keeps in place. What 275A does talk about now is to who can get the one free record. Am I reading that?
Yes, the who can get it, the free copy, as well as that time period being more precisely defined, so that there's some clarity for folks involved in this process. And we do agree, you know, this is about patients. And our member physicians and clinics want to ensure that patients get the records that they need. That's not really the issue for us. The issue is who gets the copy, at what cost, if there is a cost, and what time period are we talking about? We just want to make sure there's clarity there.
If I may.
Yeah.
Alleged onset date is an absolute concrete date that's included in every application. The same document that would tell you the date that the claim was filed will tell you the alleged onset date. There is no vagueness about that date.
Well, I would. There's no other witnesses, Professor.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. These are.
How about if we take one more try of you three guys getting together on this and coming to some consensus? If not, we'll have to decide on which way to go. But we have the Dash 2s in front of us. If that can work out, that would be great. Why don't I close the hearing and carry over a work session, say for a week, and see if you can come to some agreement. If not, we'll just go with a yes or no vote on it. Okay? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 275A. Reschedule the work session on 275A for a week from today. No. We'll just postpone the work session.
No. To suspend the rules to what representative have voted on 52.
Does she want to vote on 52?
Yes, the one that we just passed out.
Okay, can we have a motion on that?
Chair Greenlee.
We need to open a work session.
Before I get a motion to suspend the rule?
Yes. Okay, thank you.
Chair Greenlee. I move to suspend the rules so Representative Hatt can vote on Senate Bill 52A.
Representative Hayden moves to suspend the rules so that Representative Hatt can vote on House Bill.
Senate Bill 52A.
Senate Bill 52A. Any objection? No objection. Open work session to allow Representative Hatt to vote on Senate Bill 52A. How do you vote?
Aye.
Aye. Votes aye. Close the work session.
Thank you.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 786A. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committees, Senate Bill 776A requires a healthcare regulatory boards to allow healthcare practitioner to use telehealth when the health. Okay, I'm just going to start again.
You're doing fine.
Senate Bill 786A requires the Oregon Board of Dentistry to allow dental care providers to use telehealth when the provider determines it's appropriate. It requires the board to treat provisions of the dental care services in the same manner regardless of the method of the delivery of the dental care services. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact, no amendment before the committee at this time, Mr. Chair.
Do you call a panel, please?
Yes, we have Deborah Lawyer from Capital Dental Care, and this bill left the Senate floor, 28 ayes, 2 excused.
Chair Greenlich, Vice Chairs Nose and Hayden, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Deborah Loy. I'm the Executive Director of Government Programs for Capital Dental Care. We're a dental care organization that provides care to Oregon Health Plan beneficiaries. I'm here to testify on Senate Bill 786A to request your support for the bill. Capital Dental Care's purpose for introducing the bill is to clarify that dentistry delivered by telehealth methods in and of itself is not a service, but a means to collect information for services that are delivered. It further clarifies that dentistry delivered by telehealth is not an expansion of scope of a practitioner's dental care services as long as the dental care provider is providing a service that is within his or her scope of practice and they are not acting outside of that scope simply because of the telehealth methods. We believe because of personal usage of telehealth or teledentistry that it's an important addition for as a tool to the dental team. We currently have an expanded practice dental hygienist who's working in a school-based health center who's delivering telehealth information to a dentist off-site, which allows her to keep those children who she sees that are healthy, well and healthy in the community setting. We've introduced this bill to clarify the role of teledentistry as a method to deliver dental services, and we thank you for your support.
Thank you. Are there any questions in this witness? I'm saying, do you have any comments to make?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Greenlake. Telehealth has been an interesting conversation for quite some time, and we believe that we've gotten to the point that we can start to expand, particularly rural Oregon's access to some dental health from a professional point of view that can't always be done with a dentist there physically, but in conjunction with an expanded function dental hygienist can have really good outcomes for the community and provide a better level of dental oral health for them on a continuous basis that we can't always get with a licensed dentist at the place. So I don't see any concern with this. I think it's time that we expand into this area a little bit.
Okay. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 786A and open a work session on Senate Bill 786A. Representative Hayden.
Chair Greenlich, I move Senate Bill 786A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 786A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion?
No.
Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Beeler?
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon?
Aye.
Representative Kinnemer?
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Chair Greenwood?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden, will you carry?
Yes, sir.
786A, and this way to the floor. Close the work session on Senate Bill 786A. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 856A. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 856A comes to you at the request of the Osteopathic Physician Association. It allows naturopathic physicians to perform a number of activities that medical doctors and other licensed healthcare professionals are currently authorized to perform in Oregon. There is no revenue impact, Mr. Chair. Minimal fiscal impact. No amendment before you at this time. Left the Senate floor with 25 ayes, 4 noes, and 1 excused. And we have 3 folks here to testify.
Please call them.
Phil Donovan, Jeff Clark, Regina Dan? Dean?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians, and thank you, Sandy, for the background. Just a little short history on the legislation. We had the original bill drafted back in last October. You can see it's 105 some sections. We attempted to reach out to every state agency and stakeholder that might be interested or impacted by this legislation. That led us from OHA, DHS, OHSU to the stakeholders, OMA, ONA, and some parties you might not have expected us to talk to, like the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, Planned Parenthood, Right to Life. And there's a one-pager that's on OLIS that describes the outreach that was made on this legislation. And we also provided to committee staff a summary of all 105 sections into 3 convenient pages of a spreadsheet. So you can more easily peruse the bill's contents. We incorporated all of the feedback that we received from stakeholders. As a result, we didn't have any testimony in opposition to the bill on the Senate side. And with me today is Dr. Jeff Clark, who is the chair of our legislative committee and was one of the people that sat down for 2 days last fall to review the hundreds of statutes that we had identified, and also Dr. Regina Dehan, who's the chief medical officer and dean of clinics at the National University of Natural Medicine. And they'll summarize the key elements of the bill and give you a couple real-world examples to put this in context. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and if I could, I'll turn it to Dr. Clark.
Hi, for the record, my name is Jeff Clark. I'm a naturopathic physician in private practice in Tualatin, Oregon. I also serve as the volunteer legislative chair on the board of directors for the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. I'm also a member of the Oregon's Healthcare Workforce Committee. Naturopathic physicians train to provide primary care and have a scope of practice that makes them fully functional in that capacity medically. What has happened over a long time as our scope has evolved is that various administrative statutes have not evolved or been updated to reflect our scope. In so many words, we have been left behind administratively in various ways. Most of the items corrected by this omnibus bill fall into 2 main categories. The term physician isn't defined, leaving it open to interpretation, and believe me, various agencies and organizations do interpret those vague references in different ways. The term physician is specifically defined in some as an MD, DO, or nurse practitioner, even though what that statute references is clearly in the scope of practice for naturopathic physicians. Take the ability to sign off on advance directive or post forms to be an example. In our written testimony, we provide you with some specific examples of statutes that this bill would change in each of these categories, and an email from a special education teacher whose patient could not get the special education plan she needed because her naturopathic doctor simply could not sign off on her medical form. Each of these niggling items is a hindrance to the doctor and a barrier to care for patients. In the context of a state that has a chronic shortage of primary care providers, there is no value gained from forcing patients to establish care with another provider simply to have a piece of paper signed. I'll emphasize again what Phil mentioned. We have responded to the feedback from stakeholders who were kind enough to review the bill, and the product you see in front of you is a consensus bill. So.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chairman Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Regina Dehan, and as Phil said, I'm a naturopathic physician and the chief medical officer at the National University of Natural Medicine in Portland. I'm also a member of the state's Medicaid Advisory Committee, and I've been in practice in Oregon for over 20 years. I'm here to testify today in support of Senate Bill 856. I strongly urge you to adopt the bill for many reasons. First and most importantly, this bill is not an expansion of the scope of practice for naturopathic physicians. We've been granted status as primary care physicians by the Oregon Health Authority, and we've risen to that challenge. The purpose of this bill is to make consistent the definition of physician in our laws and to remove antiquated language that creates barriers to care for our patients. I want to give you a concrete example of how that antiquated language creates barriers to care and affects our patients in unexpected ways. These are jarring experiences for vulnerable patients. This is just one example of many. Currently, we're unable to refer patients for convalescent care when they're being discharged from the hospital. We have patients assigned to us as the empaneled primary care provider, so we know when they're hospitalized and we're obligated to follow up with them when they're discharged. But if they need to be transferred to convalescent care or if they need home health nursing care, we cannot order that. So this is what happened. A patient at our clinic is the legal guardian of her 15-year-old grandson. She was critically anemic when she was seen at our clinic, so we arranged to get her admitted to the hospital. Her workup showed that the bariatric surgery that she had had was leaking, and she was bleeding internally. She had to have emergency follow-up surgery, and while she was going through that, she had a heart attack. And then she went into acute renal failure. It took 5 days to get her stabilized at the hospital, and when they did, they were ready to send her home. But the only person there to care for her was her 15-year-old grandson. We tried to sign the orders to get her a home health aide, but as the law is currently written, we don't have the authority to do so, and so we couldn't do it. A great deal of hospital and clinical staff time and energy that could have been better spent caring for patients was spent trying to get this done, and in the end, she never got the help that she needed. That's just one example of the types of barriers that exist in the current legal framework. In summary, failure to support this bill negatively impacts patient care, reduces the effective workforce, reduces quality of care, and increases costs unnecessarily. Again, for all the patients who choose to see naturopathic physicians as their primary care providers, I urge you to please support Senate Bill 856 as passed by the Senate. Thank you for your service to our community and for the opportunity to testify.
Other questions of these witnesses? Representative Mueller?
Yeah, and thank you, Chair. Any of you can take this question, but can you just outline the standard training the naturopath receives?
I'll do that since I'm at the college. I focus mostly on the clinical education, which is just shy of 1,000 hours of face-to-face time with patients. The entire program is 4,400 and some hours. It is a 4-year doctoral level degree, postgraduate education.
I have a series of questions.
Let's follow on this summer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And what kind of in-hospital experience is part of that training?
Minimal.
And what kind of surgical treatment?
We have coursework in minor surgery, since none of our scope includes the insertion of instruments into body cavities. It's only superficial minor surgery.
That's very interesting. So how would you do assessment for child abuse, which is one of the section here as it gets you?
How could you clarify the question?
So one of the privileges that would be established with this bill would be assessment of child abuse, which if you're not trained in those kind of assessments, how would you be able to do that?
Oh, sorry. I was trying to make a relationship to the question about surgery, and then the child abuse question threw me off.
And you're not trained in insertion of anything.
Insertion of instruments, of surgical instruments into body cavities. We certainly can do gynecologic exams. We can do anything that doesn't involve invasion of a body cavity. So we would actually, if we had the training, we could do things like endoscopy, but we don't have the training available to us. In terms of child abuse, that is a specialty. We are trained as sexual assault examiners, and so we go through the same sexual assault examiner training that any sane nurse would do, and we can be certified as sexual assault examiners in the state. So that's a 40-hour-long training, plus a ride-along with police, plus quite a bit of psychological assessment, plus additional work with forensic examiners and forensic psychologists.
And just one further question. And do you have to take the same certification exam that both medical doctors and doctors of osteopathy have to take to practice in the state of Oregon?
It would be our privilege and pleasure to do so, but we are omitted from being able to do it because we do not have a nationwide level of acknowledgement of the licensure of naturopathic medicine. So according to the rules established by, I believe, the American Medical Association for who can sit for that exam, we are excluded. We take our own national-level physician's licensing examination in any state where naturopathic medicine is regulated.
I'd like to add on to that just a little bit. I'd like to, you are extending your scope of practice in these statutes because it's giving you authority to do things you otherwise didn't have authority to do, not whether it's in your scope. The question is, you will now have a new set of authorities. And my question, I think, relates to Representative Buehler's question, is how well are your people basically trained to do the kind of things that will be, they will now be able to do because of the amendments to the bill?
Let me jump in, Chair Greenlick. We came to this process after watching the physician's assistants do a similar exercise several years ago, and in that process, they worked with legislative counsel to identify literally hundreds of statutes that, frankly, for the most part, relate to primary care type settings. And in the course of doing that, we went through and said, that's relevant, that's not relevant. So that's why we brought forward a bill that's much smaller than the everything that was identified by legislative counsel. So in other words, it was our hope and it is to only go into those areas where our legislative committee identified that we had the training and expertise to do it successfully.
But in a sense, it is an expansion of the scope because excuse me. That's what caused the problem. The question is, you can now be able to do things that you're not otherwise able to do, not necessarily because you haven't been trained for it, but because you're not legally able. So the question is, to what extent are you, can you certify that you are trained to do the things you'll now be able to do? I think that's where Representative Buehler was going.
Mm-hmm. I think it could be established. It almost sounds like a homework assignment. It could be established that if you want us to go through the curriculum and identify those areas where there's points of concern, whether or not the training is sufficient, we can identify areas, whichever you're of interest, that would support the idea that we are educated and have practiced the things that we already find ourselves in need of doing.
Well, I think I'm not suggesting that, but I am suggesting that you really talk to us about the extent that you're really confident that that's true.
Can I? Rob?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hack.
Representative Hack?
Thank you, Chair. So while I'm supportive of naturopaths, after digging deeper and looking at this, too, I do have some concerns. On the surface, I didn't think that it was so much of a scope. But I have to say, I'm hoping, and I was hoping that you could kind of ease my angst with your testimony and not make me feel a little more of it as it relates to the change of the scope. So I, too, would like to hear more about that because I'm feeling a little uneasy about the scope of practice. Again, I'm supportive of the naturopath. I like to see people have choice. But I have to tell you, I've got some concern on the scope of practice. And also hearing some of what my colleagues have raised, I too was feeling it in reviewing in detail more of what's contained in the bill.
So if I could, Mr. Chair and Representative Hack. So, this is a large bill in the Senate. Senator Chair Monis Anderson she sat down and read every section of the bill and asked me a series of questions, which I responded to her in memo form, to which, you know, we move forward with the legislation that you see before you. If there were specific questions that you had, certain sections, it's entirely possible that I've already written something up in response to a question from Chair Montes Anderson. But I would be happy to do that sort of follow-up with you and this committee.
Yeah, that would probably be a useful thing to do. Perhaps we can, again, close the public hearing, hold over the work session. Give Representative Buell a chance to ask that, but perhaps then give you, Phil, a chance to meet with people who are worried about it and give you a chance to reassure them. Representative Buell?
Yeah. Thanks, Chair Greenlee. I have to admit, I haven't read all 119 pages.
I didn't read all of this bill.
I haven't read the whole thing either.
But I'm just going through, you know, Section 4 would, at least by my reading, which says naturopathic physicians license Dutch and Dutch may provide birth control information and services.
Mm-hmm.
So that means you could insert IUDs?
Yes,
training?
Absolutely. We're trained. I myself go annually to the Contraceptive Technology Conference in San Francisco, California, that is considered the best practices across the country. And I just do that as a refresher. That is in addition to the work that I did as an undergraduate, well, as a graduate student in medical school. IUDs are definitely within the scope of practice. The thing that's in that law right now is whether or not we can do that with confidentiality. It's actually unclear whether or not I would be required to tell the patient's parents that they had sought me out for care, or if I could maintain that confidentiality. I'm glad you brought that up.
And then further, possible care, surgical diagnosis or treatment? I mean, and you just said you don't really have surgical treatment, so it seems like a broad expansion, at least by my reading.
You know, someone who's not a practitioner, it would be helpful if the people who have concerns would just sort of call them out super specifically. And I get we're all just sort of going through this here, you know, because none of us thought this was a controversial bill. And I don't think it is. But it would be useful, like, if someone made a list of, like, here's the 4 or 5 or 10 things that would be, I'd like a little more discussion about, so that our witnesses are prepared and then I can prepare a little bit too. Because I'm just now scanning this and don't have the same reservation, but I think I would do a better job following along if I got that in advance.
Well, let's do that. Let's reschedule the work session on this bill for a week from today and ask people to produce any questions you have for the witnesses. We'll call you back as invited testimony on the work session, and let's see if you can help allay any concerns people have.
Absolutely, we'd be happy to do that,
yes,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Chair, we'd be happy to do so.
That's great. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 856A. Postpone the work session to a week from today. Senate Bill 856A. Let's open up a work session on Senate Bill. Oh, wait. Before I do that, let me announce we're going to carry over Senate Bill 754A until Wednesday. That will be carried over. Open up a work session on Senate Bill 271. Madam Administrator, would you remind us of what we have, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 271 came to you at the request of Tom Holt of Cambia. Modifies the current definition of small employer to an average of at least one, but not more than 50 full-time employees during the preceding calendar year. We had the public hearing on April 26th. This has no revenue impact, no minimal impact, no amendment, and again, it left the Senate 29 ayes and one excused.
Sounds like a good consent calendar bill.
Sure. No
objection. Let's have a motion.
All right.
Include the consent calendar.
Chair Greenlick, I would like to move Senate Bill 271 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that would be placed on the consent calendar.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 271 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon?
Aye.
Representative Kenneman?
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Yes.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Chair Greenland?
Yes. Motion carries. 271 goes to the floor on the consent calendar. Open the work session on Senate Bill 271. Open the work session on Senate Bill 561A. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 561 had a public hearing on April the 26th. This came to us at the request of the Oregon Health Sciences University. You'll recall this permits students of dentistry and dental hygiene to perform under indirect supervision by faculty in specific community-based or clinical settings. This declares an emergency is effective on passage. We have a no revenue, no fiscal impact. You do have a dash A2 amendment, which expands the expands it to include the practice of dental hygienist students as well under the indirect supervision piece of it. And Mr. Chair, on the A2s, there still is no revenue and no fiscal impact if the committee decides to adopt the A2s.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Greenlake. This is somewhat of a rare bill that we see come through because it's a common sense bill.
Ouch! I feel puked.
If it's so good, why don't you?
And I was going to support it.
You got 5 votes. You want to go for 4?
Yeah. Thick
in here. I'll take my 5 votes. Yeah. Basically, it allows the teaching educations to have a dentist supervising more than one operatory unit, which have low walls and they can clearly see what's going on, so it just allows them to do their job more efficiently.
Have a motion?
Chair Green, like I move
amendment
to adopt dash A2 to Senate Bill 561 dated 4/2017.
Representative Hayden moves the dash A2 amendments to Senate Bill 561A, dated 4/2017. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
Mr. Chair, just a clarification on what the amendment actually does to the...
The amendment adds the dental hygiene supervision to the dental supervision. Two different training programs.
In the same clinical setting.
So dental hygienists can now oversee the training of other dental hygienists.
Right now, in the training program, the supervisor directs one-to-one supervision to the dental hygienist. This allows them to do it in a group way. The same supervisor.
And the supervisor, dentist?
It's a dentist.
In an indirect
setting. Before it was one-to-one, and now they can do it in a group.
Whatever.
Thank you.
Any objection to the motion? Okay. Representative Hayden?
Chair Greenlake, I recommend a due pass to Senate Bill 561-A2 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I didn't quite get that right, but you got it.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 561-A to the floor as amended with the A2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Could you call the roll, please?
Representative
Kennedy. Aye.
Representative
Buehler.
Yes.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kennedy.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack.
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose.
I guess I'll be a yes.
Yes.
Yes. Motion carries. Senate Bill 561A as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation. Representative Hayden will carry it.
Thank you.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 561A. Open a work session on Senate Bill 966. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 966 comes to you at the request of the Oregon Dental Association. Had a public hearing on this on last Wednesday, the 3rd of May. This requires any licensed dental professional who uses an autoclave or other heat sterilization device to test the device at least once per week. There's no fiscal, no revenue. This left the Senate 30 ayes.
We have a motion.
Am I doing this one?
Let's let Hayden do this one, too.
This is just a straight
loop. I wonder if he can get
Eric
it right.
Greenlick.
You can carry
I move Senate Bill 966 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 966 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I have a point of discussion.
Yeah.
I am in favor of the bill, but this is one of those examples where I asked Representative Hayden afterwards, why are we putting this in statute? Apparently because it was in statute before with a longer time period. I think it was once a month. But even that, I see as a little ridiculous that it's in statute. These are the kind of things that should be determined as scope of practice by the Board of Dentistry. Nonetheless, it's here. I'll vote for it.
I agree completely.
I knew you would.
I thought the same exact thing last night when I read this. I don't know why these things are in statute.
Yeah. Is this the once a month and once a week, or is this the dentist or anybody in the office?
This was changed from once a month to once a week in statute for reasons before I was here.
Yeah, before.
It changed it for a dentist only. Now they've realized they needed to include expanded function dental hygienist, or if a dental assistant actually did that procedure for a dentist to confirm.
All these questions allows them to plan.
It was changed to weekly.
Yes.
Long ago.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. And that just kind of emphasizes my point. I'm sure that was kind of standard practice now for years, and statute is just now catching up, and it just seems unnecessary and excessive to me. And also, it's just not going to keep up in the changes practices. So you're going to have lots of people potentially practicing dentistry out of statute, out of
well, we will, because we're
here we go again.
To do it.
I'm not defending the statute. It would be better an administrative rule, in my opinion, but it currently is in statute, so it would have to be removed from statute and put into an administrative rule, and that's not the route that they went.
Are we ready for a vote?
Representative Kenneman.
Well, it just may be that our token dentist needs to propose that for a bill next session to remove
to remove all this stuff.
Because I do think that is more consistent. We're trying to get out of this silly item-by-item recommendation and get to general scope of practice issues and let the local boards regulate the specifics that change over time.
I will observe without specificity that some boards are more rational in their behavior than other boards.
Would you name those, please?
Here we go.
No, I won't, but sometimes it's helpful to give them some guidance.
But I'm ready to vote, but I don't want to carry the bill because I'll get all these weird questions.
Representative Kenny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Buehler.
No.
Representative Alonzo Leon.
Aye.
Representative Kenneman.
Aye.
Representative Maelstrom.
Aye.
Representative Hack?
I'm going to go with my good friend, Mr. Buehler, down there and be a no.
Vice Chair Nose?
Sure.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Yes.
Pass it.
Chair
Green.
Yes. And Representative Hayden carry this one.
It's good.
Thank you.
There won't be any questions in the carrier then. That'll be nice.
It's a lot of work.
Let's send out a memo and suggest some questions.
Senate Bill 966.
Practices change.
Oh, mercy.
And we are adjourned.
Thank God.
We are adjourned.
Thank God. Mercy.
And we